The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So what I'm about to say is not likely to inspire confidence in your meditation teacher for the day, but it's true. Teaching meditation is hard. It's not at all clear to me how to do it. And my mind pulls in very different directions. So on the one hand, there's this kind of wish to give these vague, impressionistic instructions that are not very clearly pointing to a particular experience or a way of attending. And then there's this other side of my mind that is like very attuned to the value of precision and knowing exactly where the attention is supposed to be in each moment and having a highly prescribed way of attending to phenomena. And I really haven't been able to resolve that ambivalence. It's like sometimes I'll get up here and I'm like, all right, I'll have some plan of doing, we're gonna sit like this, yeah? And I'll get up here, it doesn't quite feel right, and I sort of back away from the edge of whatever slightly fundamentalist impulse I had, and I'll just be vague, yeah? And, a certain kind of rigidity in how one practices, this kind of like singular commitment to a way of practicing, very helpful in some ways to just not acknowledge the kind of nuance or my own ambivalence about how to practice, what to prescribe. That's helpful. It's helpful sometimes just to be really simple and just do something, be committed to it. And I have to find ways of respecting the fact that we're all different and the mind needs different things at different moments. And sometimes if we are too intent on generating particular way of practicing and flavor of practice, we miss some of the kind of peripheral dimensions of the mind. Yeah, so if we're too focused in attending in a very particular way, there's a certain kind of loss in not just grappling with the wildness of inner life and of essentially finding our own way, like innovating, improvising our own way of practicing. And just in the course of a day, you'll need to do that. Yeah, like at some point, the traditional set of instructions are not going to be so useful. Now, we don't bail as soon as it gets a little slippery or something, but there's a kind of intuitive wisdom that arises in discerning when we actually, it is time to improvise. And when pivoting to some other way of being with experience is not grasping or avoidance or boredom or something, but is actually skillful. Yeah. And so discerning when that is, like feeling into when one's improvisations in practice are not a manifestation of greed, hatred, delusion, but instead a kind of expression of some wisdom. That's important for us, yeah? And so... maybe the organizing idea is that whatever we're doing, we're here to learn and to love. You know, that is a kind of overarching themes. We're here not to... in some ways, the commitment of Buddhist practice is like, I will not squander pain. Yeah, I will not squander the first noble truth, that there is suffering. Yeah, I will actually leverage that in some way to learn and to love. Last night was teaching, and teaching with a friend, and we topic was memory. We talk all about the present moment and being present, but in an important sense, the present is composed entirely of the past. Like what is given to us in this moment is an expression, maybe we could say, some sense poetically, in some sense really, like what's here reflects everything that's come before. In his memoir of the Holocaust, losing his family, surviving, Elie Wiesel said, in the end, it is all about memory, its origins and its magnitude, and of course, its consequences. And so as we sit today, we're attending to the present moment. But to attend to the present moment in a way is to be blessing the past with wisdom and love, with awareness and love. So memory arises, like what's undigested in the heart in the past arises, and we do what we can to bless it. Yeah? And we do that quietly. It's not a dramatic gesture. This is the way our past starts to be completed, to feel whole, to take off the kind of to scrub down the jagged edges of any life. And then as that process unfolds, it feels more and more safe to actually rest in what's here. That sense of like we can't be ambushed by history so much. So there's this totally kind of poetic, jazz-like, improvisational side of practice. And then there can be, that can be complemented, augmented by other times when it's, when precision and a kind of moment, you know, kind of a certain kind of diligence, attentional diligence is really essential. And so just to sketch out one way of practicing in that, that's been useful for me and has articulated kind of by a teacher of mine, Shinzen Young, a kind of streamlining of this, of the skandhas in a way, the aggregate. So Shinzen was sort of very much from the kind of early Buddhist approach that we're to look in some ways at the full pie of human experience, and our failure to actually appreciate the pieces of that pie lead to the misperception of self. Yeah. And it's actually through this process of an untangling and distilling out the different channels of data that enter awareness that we become more and more free. And so from this perspective, it is a precise way of practicing. And this does not represent the full kind of range of human experience, but three very familiar and cardinal experiences that it is useful to distinguish are emotional feeling in the body, internal images, and in mental chatter, words, think, what we usually just call thinking. So, feeling in the body, that we can distinguish between, for example, the sensations of me tapping on my chest right here, which is a kind of physical sensation, from the sensations I would have in my chest if there were suddenly a loud noise. Yeah? If there were a loud, startling noise, I would also have sensations in my chest, but they would feel different than this. Right? And that's all that's being pointed to, nothing more mystical than that. That and it's usually along the front axis of the body, in the face, in the throat, in the chest, the belly. It is charged with emotionality, with responses to pleasure and pain, with responses to threat and opportunity. It can be triggered by thinking itself. There is a thought and then a cascade of feeling in the body. Sometimes there's feeling in the body, emotional feeling in the body, and then the mind comes to try to match it or understand it or neutralize it. So there's agitation in the kind of the body, and then we look for an explanation, what went wrong, and then the story we tell, in a sense, comes to match the feeling in the body. Is that making sense? Yeah. This kind of category of experience of emotional, emotional sensation in the body is, maybe the one of the most useful kind of distinctions in meditation practice, and so much freedom comes out of a skillful relationship with the emotional charge of the body. It's not just like, oh, it's just our emotional life and that's the realm of psychotherapy or something. It is that in a beautiful way, And it's a lot more than that too, because our growing freedom depends in large part on how safe it feels amidst intensity. Yeah. And to actually come to feel more and more at home with the kind of this pervasive, the opportunities and threats are everywhere. For small creatures like us, they're everywhere. Yeah? And there's something in the system that is always calibrating to that. The movements of the mind, right? And so we actually start to see, oh, I'm like, each moment is a kind of down payment on survival, yeah? On being actually okay, right? This, like, you know, the kind of self-preservation, the need to keep going, which is innocent and totally natural. But that has effects, because what it does is it turns this moment into a kind of we need to ensure that this moment points to another moment, yeah? And to really start to actually settle into this moment means that we have to be able to feel our way through that labyrinth of threat and opportunity. So we start to develop some clarity with this kind of like the emotional charge in the body. And sometimes it will be intense, sometimes subtle, sometimes it's very localized. Sometimes the most intense kind of feeling is spread broadly across the body, coded in feeling. Maybe subtle, we don't even notice it, but we know we want something. Yeah? We know we want something to stop. When we come back from lunch, 1:30, look for this experience. It will arise in something like, something ain't right. Yeah? I could use a nap or something, but it's going to be like, a lot of times it's this pervasive, the body just drenched in feeling, but maybe not so intense, and we actually can miss it. To the extent that you are bored right now, or agitated, or enjoying, or curious, that is a function that has a fingerprint in the body, yeah? And starting to actually appreciate that moment by moment, yeah? Almost like this kind of lava lamp, amoeba-like emotional body that's responding moment by moment to sensory experience. Developing clarity with this, with the kind of flavors in the emotional body, equanimity with it, of actually loving, opening the heart, loving it. Yeah. And then images, like, yeah, this is how memory arises, but also how we simulate the future and make predictions and make plans. Fleeting mental images that often tangle with these other sensory experiences. So there's a pain in the knee, there's the kind of physical sensations of that, but then there's a kind of emotional, the levers of craving and aversion operate at the level of the emotional body. So there's that is activated, and then maybe there are these images of the knee, fleeting or stable images they're kind of dancing together. And these images may be in memory, they may be really prominent, but they may be quite fleeting. They are the images of our own body, the images of our own sense of being headquartered behind the eyes. They are the images of this room. Yeah. And we come to appreciate all of that as experience that is of the nature to arise and pass. And then there is what we usually just call, thinking, the words in our own minds. And thinking has a kind of a gravitational pull to it that's striking. It's almost as if the words in their embryonic state are like begging us to think them. Yeah. If you actually scan the kind of whole body mind, what is most prominent in experience are usually the words in our own head. Yeah. It has this kind of like sacred, hallowed ground for us. And we believe quite deeply in our thinking. We're devoted to it. And that is no doubt in part because it's our intelligence and capacity to problem solve is genius. It's amazing. Yeah? It's amazing. But it's like we start to imagine that the only way to ever solve a problem is to think. And that's the delusion. And that robs us of a deeper connection with the present moment, where other mechanisms of healing are put in place just in resting here. We cannot think our way to freedom, even though it feels like if I just turned, put this there, that, you know, like, I could finally straighten out the world. Yeah. And so we use our thoughts we use our intelligence. It's totally beautiful. And we don't, we're careful not to let it overpromises to us. Yeah. Our redemption is not found in the realm of discursive thought. So those words that are sometimes subtle and sometimes very prominent, the words that usually catch us in stream, it's a very different experience to be lost in the content of a sentence where the attention it all goes there, and we actually lose all of our dharma in a way. In some ways, thinking is totally useful, and we are giving ourselves little dharma pep talks throughout the day. Like, Matthew's going to be quiet soon. Just be patient. Yeah. Right? It's good. You actually have to give yourself little pep talks. Yeah? We can appreciate the way in which we really lose the thread of like the perception of dukkha, anicca, anatta, the three characteristics of unsatisfactoriness, impermanence, ungovernability, not self. Like, we really lose that when we're identified with thought. It's like we can't help but become But we can't help but pick up a certain worldview when we're identified with thought. So how these actual experiences work with each other, this is a gift of practice, to know ourselves deeply. Yeah, to know ourselves deeply. So these three experiences of feeling, of image, of internal talk, you can practice with this. This is the kind of core triad of self and self-making. And as the kind of the rhythms of the day unfold and you are enjoying or struggling or whatever it is, like, it's worth checking out what is happening in these three fields of experience. And that could be a casual kind of check, or it may be done in a very formal kind of way where you're actually doing a kind of a noting practice. And so every few seconds you're noting one of these three experiences: feeling, image, talk. More than one will be arising almost all the time. But that's, we don't have to focus on more than one. We just sort of don't make a big deal of what you attend to. And it may be that your attention is drawn to the emotional body a lot. And so you're just noting, feeling. Maybe that kind of label is enough. Maybe it's useful just to say feeling, feel, something like this. Maybe you want to be more specific if it feels like that has a particular emotional flavor. Oh, this is impatience. And to actually discern that this is impatience, in some ways we're consulting with the activity in the mind, with the images and the words, to discern that this is impatience. Yeah? Like triangulating, to actually get a sense of what is in what the flavor of feeling is. And that's fine. We can call it impatience. We do what we can to open to the constellation of sensations and give it radical permission to be what it is, for this moment to be imperfect as it is, to not need to sort out everything that's right and wrong with this moment, but just rest here. So we can be noting, okay, we're actually, there's feeling, there's talk, there's image. And we can actually just use these three experiences as a way of becoming more deeply known to ourselves, and to begin to untangle the optical illusion of self. We don't go looking for insight, we just go looking for what's here. This too is a way of blessing our past. Yeah. So with feeling, we feel. With images, we see. With words, we hear. To be mindful of feeling is to feel. To be mindful of images is to see. to be mindful of talk is to hear. And we do that with clarity. We feel, we see, we hear with clarity. Questions before we get up and stretch and walk?
You used the word redemption. I think mm-hmm. you said redemption is not found in thinking. Mm-hmm. Can you say more about redemption?
It's interesting that I used that word. I like that word. Some ways we want to, part of our Dharma practice is seeing where we, place our hope and where we seek to take refuge. And that sense of redemption, it's a poignant word for me because it connotes this possibility of a certain way in which we actually rescue the pain of the past and the pain of the human condition. And remarkably, it is possible to transmute that pain into wisdom and love. Yeah? That's a big claim, right? That is not something you want to trust from anybody saying it. But that is something we can check out for ourselves. That the redemption of our past, the redemption of pain, is through this kind of alchemical process of willingness, of care, of equanimity, of allowing that the cord to unfurl in the heart and to trust that we actually don't need to understand the whole process. We don't need to be tracking insight moment by moment. The logic of the Dharma is its own logic. The logic of our own healing and awakening, it's encoded in the practice, and it's not our job to manufacture it. We're just like, okay, here's this memory, yeah? Something's come up. And rather than actually trying to compulsively rewrite our autobiography, yeah? We just let it unfold as an experience arising now. Yeah. Okay, feeling like this, images of the past arising now, words, commentary. We get really curious, still patient with this. Yeah. And then it's through that process and through that kind of digestion process that then we actually can come to rewrite our autobiography in more and more nuanced, intelligent, Dharma ways. Yeah, we are blessing our past. Yeah. And that becomes a kind of sense of refuge. Yeah. like just to trust that no matter what suffering is here, we have this deep trust, like no matter what suffering is here, I know something else is always also true. Just feel our way into that. So today is, I leave it to you to determine how to practice, yeah? Like how regimented or organized or impressionistic, how much practice is it, you want to make it a technique or you want to make it this kind of undirected way of exploring what it's like to be human. Without set categories of where to look or where in the mind to try to find wisdom and love, but just to explore. And it's a time for you to just to give permission for the feeling, the life of the emotional body to just run through. Leonard Cohen said, I cried for you this morning and I'll cry for you again, but I'm not in charge of sorrow, so please don't ask me when. Whatever's here. Okay, you can feel the unfurling. And sometimes we get identified with the contents of the experience and then we recognize experience as experience. We step out in some way and appreciate like, oh, one way of understanding my life is in the story of it. That's legitimate. And there is another way of understanding my life, which is fleeting sensory experience. It's good to be with you. Look forward to connecting. And so we'll have a period of walking. If anybody has any questions, we're at time. So if you have questions, I can check in with Cheryl about walking. It seems like most everybody's been here and knows the way practice. But please, if there are any questions, please ask Cheryl. And I wish you a good day of practice. I'll be sort of mostly in the back room, but popping out a little bit and. We'll do this together. So, thank you.